Ladies and gentlemen, I feel real privileged to participate in this 100th anniversary of the founding of the American Society of Agronomy, and especially since it also marks that Mark Carlton was the first president of this society. And I found out about the sad part of his very productive life once in Lima, Peru, when I was scheduled to go from the hotel to the experiment station La Molina. I blew a tire, and I got out and took a walk when they were changing the tire. And here I found that on a post, ahead, and a brass plate, Mark Carlton. Prior to that, I had known about all the great work he had done in introducing different kinds of wheats into the winter wheat regions of the USA, and especially agronomic practices that made them productive. But I never knew the sad part of his life until I came back and went through the literature that was never very explicit, how he was working to pay off his debts. He had resigned because of a lot of politics that were involved in that time. So politics got into science pretty early also. Now let's turn to the important thing and see what the problems are for the future. These are the challenges for crop scientists during this century, this new century. And in order to orient us, we need to have some idea of what the nature and size of the production of the food that's required for the 6.4 billion people at the present time. In 2004, the production was about 5.2 billion gross tons of food, reduced to 2.5 of tons of dry edible matter, or expressed as kilocalories, edible matter. And of those, as you can see from the chart, cereals constitute 70%. This doesn't mean that those other seven categories are not important, but cereals are the big ones. If we fail on that, we fail generally. And we look at what it takes to double the food production during the next four decades to the year 2050. And most of this production, 75%, will have to come from land already under cultivation. And this limited production of extension of more area under cultivation is limited except in certain parts of the Americas, especially Latin America and some in Latin and North America also. And if all of the crying and moaning about changing climates, maybe we better start looking at some of the permafrost in the northern part of the Americas too. I don't think that's very feasible at the present time. But we're going to have to use our irrigation water more productively. Now let's take a glance at what's happened in the last half century. The last half century is the greatest change in food production around the world that civilization has ever seen, both in the developed and in the developing nation. In the developing nations, however, in the middle 60s, things were grim, and there were many who said, forget about working in India, and maybe Pakistan could be safe. That was the state of the art. No one knew how bad the situation was in China, which was worse at that time than India. But look what's happened in those countries. And I've been privileged to be a small part of seeing some of that unfold, participating in building the technology and spreading it. And it was done in all cases through young scientists that came to Mexico, spend two crop seasons with our small Rockefeller Foundation Mexican government program, which began in 1944. And from then until very recently, the 68 years I've spent in third world agriculture pretty largely, except for one semester each year at Texas A&M. Now look at that Indian chart. Millions of tons of wheat. It was static at 11 million tons during the first 6 years of '60s. And then it jumped to 75 million tons by the end of the century. The yields, average yield, went from under, much of it under irrigation, from 850 kilos per hectare to 2.9 tons. And look at what happened in population. Despite that huge growth in population, India became self-sufficient in basic cereal grains in 1953 and has been self-sufficient since, except this last year when there was some mismanagement about selling off too much stock. So despite the population growth in India from 452 million to more than a billion, that progress was made. We have to move on, and the situation in China is even more impressive. They got started a decade later than India and than Pakistan. Cereal total productions of all cereals increased from 91, as you can see, 91 million tons to 390, essentially a threefold increase. Yields went up nearly four times, and their population increased from 660 to 1,200,000,000, being self-sufficient. And where did this, what contributed to this? Many factors. High-yielding, well-adapted, disease-resistant varieties were one important component. But the high-yielding variety alone, and I say this, and I spent most of my life breeding wheat varieties, alone won't produce much results. It has to have food, fertilizer, nutrients. And I saw the situation in Mexico on some of the old parts, my first years there, where under irrigation, yields were 400, 500 kilos per hectare, 8 to 10 bushels. And I knew you couldn't do much, no matter how good the variety, that potential business didn't count. And so I became a stout scholar of agronomy and soils, as well as working on all of the other factors that add up to changing production. The fertilizer industry. China is a good example of one of the countries that's most adept at using all organic waste, human, animal waste, crop residue. But look what's happened in the last four decades in increasing up chemical fertilizer, the pink part of your chart, or yellow part of your chart. The organic cycling, even though they're the world experts at this, constitutes a small amount. And yet if you listened to a lot of the people who were advocating organic fertilizer, and I've always said, use all the organic fertilizer. God bless you. But don't come into the third world and tell them that you can feed 6.6 billion people with organic fertilizer. This is pure nonsense, and that's still going on today. And as we... And as we look ahead now, suddenly we're short and scared about energy. What's happened to petroleum, the prices? And that first chart on your left shows the organic or the cereals or crops being converted to liquid energy. You can barely see that yellow line. The second one on the right is a breakdown of that little line. You see that the purple is the amount of ethanol produced from sugarcane in Brazil, and then the corn and certain of the other grains. But they constitute a very small amount. But what's likely to happen now is my fears, that I don't blame the farmer. I think it's to his advantage. But there'll be too much of basic grain diverted. The price is going to skyrocket. And what's going to happen to the cost of meat, starting with pork, chicken, eggs, all the animals' products. So it shows how integrated all of these factors are. And I mentioned that the amount of area that we can bring under the plow is still limited. Of course, the breakthrough in bringing into production the Cerrado acid soils of Brazil in the last 15 years is buying a lot of time. These are very productive. They were essentially worthless before, with low carrying capacity in a short period when the grasses were green. Grasses are unpalatable, poorly with poor nutrition. They grade into brush and small twisted trees. These were never the savannas that you hear that these developments are destroying the tropical savannas or the tropical forest. These were grasslands and brushlands, and they have made tremendous change in production, especially in soybeans and in corn or maize. But other crops are coming in. The area is handicapped now by shortage of transport, but this is being corrected, and it will be one of the areas that will help carry the world through to produce the food that I predict will be necessary and can be achieved for the growing population up through the year 2050. Despite this tremendous change in production, we've still got hungry people. There's 800 million. But what would it have been in India, Pakistan, in Turkey, in Egypt, in many other countries, China included, had there not had been this change in due to science and technology? And we have 800 million hungry people. Where are they? Those charts show you where they are. And surprisingly, a large number of them are landless people or farmers living on very marginal lands. And is Africa as hopeless as most people here dictate? We move on and we see that this represents probably 300,000 tests on farmers' fields of sizable plots, a quarter of a hectare in many cases, mostly more than half an acre. And the red is the national average of corn yields in each of those countries. The green are the actual measured yields that we have on this large number of tests over the last 20 years in those different countries of Africa. So there's potential there, but again, you can't eat it that way. You've got to convert it. And so this gets to be a problem that's related and shown on this next graph, the fertilizer. How do you move it into a country without any roots? And so for the time being, look at the African nations. You can barely see the red for all of those African nations. If this chart had been built 30 years ago, look where China is. Look where India is, up on a par with UK. They would have been down where the African countries are today. This is what restoring soil fertility has done for the developing nations. And we move on to one of the other basic structures that's been a handicap to Africa and still is. Shortage of infrastructure, roads, highways, railroads. In the case of Asia, the railroads were built into the Punjab, the best agricultural area. Why? For cotton fiber to feed the industrialization of Britain. And as soon as the railroads were there, farmers and provincial governments built railroads or built the roads, all weather roads to build cotton to the railroad. So when the wheats moved in, the roads were there. They had done a good job on developing irrigation during the colonial period. And we had the varieties and the cultural practices and the fertilizer. And this is what happened. In Africa, the railroads went to the mines, to the diamond mines and to the mineral mines. And there was agriculture was not important. And they're still paying the cost of that because of lack of infrastructure. Once a railroad goes in, or even a road, an all-weather road, there will soon be schools. And a short time later, some medical officers. Everything begins to change. A few broken up, beaten up old trucks moving fertilizer seed across. And that's crossing ethnic borders, linguistic borders. Everything starts to change. That infrastructure impacts in many different ways. So what Africa needs now is a sort of a Marshall Plan, if you want to call it that. That's essentially what the Green Revolution was in some aspects. It needs roads, which will bring the schools. And the schools don't need to be built in big fancy building out under the trees very often. And there will be some medical officers. And the farmers producing grain will find a market the way it is now. In a good year in some of those countries, like in Ethiopia 4 years ago, we had big surpluses in an area where we could move fertilizer in and the rains were good. And 200 miles away, people starving. We couldn't move the grain from the surplus to the deficit area. So we have to improve our irrigation also and to meet these world food needs. And we need to remember that irrigation, 70% of the water taken out of water systems goes for irrigation, but the efficiency of use of this at the present time is very low. And although only 17% of the total world area is irrigated, it produces 40% of the agricultural food produce. And conservation tillage is moving fast into many parts of the third world. We can conserve moisture by 20 to 25% by bed planting and rather than flood irrigation. At the same time, there's a vast amount of information that shows that the efficiency of the fertilizer under bed planting is greatly improved. And thirdly, in those areas where you can have multiple cropping on the same land two or three times a year, you don't have to plow and disc and prepare the land. If you have the right simple equipment to plant on top of the beds, simply reinforce them and do little movement of the soil per se. All of these are things that we need to expand greatly, but they're beginning to move in countries like China, India, Pakistan, and Turkey right now. Then we move on to breeding objectives. Dr. Horst and his early work before he joined the organization, which he's with now, which I'm glad to see that he's there, because I think that his background of experience in biotechnology has been already accomplished is tremendous, and we're going to need more and more of this transgenic plant breeding, if you want to call it that. And it will attack many phases where we're stuck now. For example, the maize there on the bottom of corn shows stress tolerance to drought. The one on your left is the one that's ordinarily grown now, whereas that one on the right are some of the new lines or varieties that have a great deal of tolerance to drought at certain stages. There will be many other types of breakthroughs like this. But we have to remember that we forget to do our homework, and that rust there on the right hand shows that in biological world, a job is never done. It's not only in the case of human diseases that bacteria develop resistance to Staphylococcus or to gonococci or whatever bacterium. It happens all the time in the world of agriculture also. And in the case of the rust fungi especially, or the spores can be blown in huge numbers for hundreds of miles. And if the varieties are susceptible, moisture is there, temperatures are favorable, you can have explosive epidemics with tremendous losses. The American people have forgotten about this. They never had the breakdown of stem rust since 1951, 2, 3, and 4, when there were tremendous damages. And it was through that we finally got real international collaboration going. And our little Mexican program, the Rockefeller and Mexican government made it feasible for the Canadians and the U.S. to have winter breeding plots in Mexico, so they doubled up. They learned from our shuttle breeding where we had grown two crops of segregating material every year so that we could produce new varieties in half the time that normally was required, but even greater, that had insensitivities to whether the days were getting shorter or longer during the time of planting. All of these are part of this story. This race of stem rust broke out in Uganda in 1998, but it wasn't. I tried to get people interested. I'd retired by then. They said, oh, that's no longer a problem. We got leaf rust and yellow rust. We work on those. Stem rust, no longer a problem. Now it turns out that with funding mostly from the USDA and Rockefeller Foundation and more recently several other organizations, we've got those nurseries reestablished in Kenya and Ethiopia. And it turns out that virtually all of the high-yielding dwarf varieties are susceptible to these two new strains of rust. And had we just maintained that nursery, which cost very little, we wouldn't be in this predicament. We've got identified now several strains, high yielding, desirable from other standpoint. But it takes 3, 4, 5, 6 years to multiply these so you can cover millions of acres with the seed. So we aren't out of the woods yet. We can have a real disaster. And that's why you have to have continuity in these programs. Now, we look at this global genetically modified organism. It's amazing how fast it's growing. There's 252 million acres, mostly in corn and cotton and soybeans. And the countries you can see there, U.S., Argentina, Brazil, are the leaders, and are moving rapidly in that direction. And as we look towards the future, I predict that biotechnology or transgenic crossing two varieties that we could not cross to because of sterility barriers with conventional genetics and plant breeding will play more and more of an active role in many different aspects as we move forward in the next decade. And there's one thing about this movement to transgenics. Unfortunately, the funds for support in the public sector has been going down. Within the last 2 years, it's starting to come up. But it's being carried for by the private sector. But who's going to train the young scientists if we don't have good breeding programs using transgenics in our university? We can't neglect and let their programs dry up, or we will do a disservice to the whole world community. And so I plead that we don't forget the role of the public sector, universities, land-grant colleges, reinvigorating their research, employing transgenics, even though it looks like they are being pushed out. They are not. They are vital to the private sector in the long run. And I think the private sector realizes that and has been trying to correct this in the last several years. And feeding future populations. I think the world has the technology now to feed the 10 billion people that may inhabit this and likely will inhabit the planet Earth by the year 2050 or 2060. Certainly the chances are much better than it was in 1960 when all the crying and moaning about nothing could be done to save India, maybe Pakistan. We didn't even know how bad it was in China. And look what happened. And that was done by young people in a large part. I have spent most of my career in training young people in trying to develop a package of technology, not just the breeding, the variety, the agronomic practices, land preparation to make sure you get good stands of plants, restoring soil fertility, control of weeds, diseases and insects, and then demonstrating what that package of practices can do on farmers' fields. And then in the quiet of the office of top policymakers, in the absence of the press, when things are getting pretty hungry in those countries, there's some down-to-earth talking that needs to be done. And I've been surprised how often it's been effective. It doesn't sound like the way things should be done, but that's the way it happens in the real world. And so I've been through many of these shoving and pushings and maybe, and I've seen real big breakthroughs. And I don't like the pessimism. I always say to my young students, be positive. Reach, stretch yourself, stretch your ability, reach for the stars. You'll never reach that star, but if you stretch yourself enough, you'll get some stardust on your hand. And with that, you'll be surprised what can happen to you, your family, the community, the state, the nation, and yes, to the people of the world. And like Lloyd Bord Orr, the first developer, first director of the world, director of FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, you can't build peace on empty stomach. I'm a firm believer in this, because the hungry are not reasonable. I wouldn't be either if I saw my family starving. And you don't follow laws. So you young people, reach and stretch and achieve. Thank you all.
Thank you, Dr. Borlaug and Dr. Horsch, for speaking with us tonight and inspiring us with your words and especially with your lives. In order to show our appreciation and to commemorate your lectures this evening, we have a plaque for each one of you. And I'll read just the inscription on the one. The American Society of Agronomy recognizes Norman E. Borlaug and Robert Horsch as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2007 ET in Bam York Distinguished ASA Lecture. Thank you very, very much for being with us this evening. I think everybody in this room was inspired. I hope you all realize what an historic occasion this has been and what a privilege and an honor to have Dr. Borlaug with us. And so I'd like you all to stand and show him our appreciation once again.